Well, I'm Mark Miller with a graduate student with UCF, and I'm here with Peter Newman, director, writer, everything to do with Celery Soup, and a powerhouse behind Creative Sanford. So we're here for an interview. So have you been with the project from the beginning, Creative Sanford and Celery Soup or anything?
Creative Sanford actually started probably 3 years before we actually put on the first the first performance. It was based on Swamp Gravy, which started in Colquitt in Georgia, and Janine Taylor, who runs the gallery across the way there, was really the fountain of it. She came back from seeing Swamp Gravy and decided she wanted to do the same here in Sanford. And she'll be able to tell the story better than I can, but somebody, I believe, gave her either a check or a cash of $200 and said, there you go, let's start it. They ran 3 to 4 years worth of funding within the community, doing things like the Celery Ball primarily and other things like that, before they actually pushed the boat out and got hold of a company up north that actually also helped to create Swamp Gravy, and they came down here and they did the first show. They were helping with the tea and tells, which is the way the community stories were obtained. And then they have various professional people, like a playwright, and she took the stories, put them together and produced the play. Then they had professional directors, choreographers, lighting and all the rest of it. And they came together and they produced the first Touch and Go. It's called Touch and Go because as you probably know, there was an Air Force, was it a Navy base here? They flew aircraft anyhow. It was Navy because the Touch and Go was practicing carrier landing. So what they'd come is they'd come down in their jets, touch the tarmac and then take off again. So hence the Touch and Go, you see, that's what we used to call it. And one of the people who was associated with it very early on, he had a story about, you know, watching the planes do that when he was young in the Second World War, just after. But we felt that after we'd done Touch and Go, and it was a success, I mean, there's no doubt about it, that after that, that we could, you know, really kind of run with it ourselves. I mean, you know, there were a nice enough bunch of people that were used to doing it, but they charged an arm and a leg. So, you know, you can only sustain that for so long. And particularly in a place like this, you know, Colquitt, Georgia is an amazing place. If you go up there to watch Swamp Gravy, it is the only show in town, and people come from miles. I mean, it is unbelievable when you go up there to see the hundreds of people that come to it, and they come from all over. Whereas here, on any one night that we're putting on something by Celery Soup, you can guarantee that there are between perhaps 4 to 10 other live shows going on in theatres within perhaps a 30-mile radius, and I believe that is primarily due to the number of people here that are associated with Disney. And of course, you know, that that helps with the whole creative process when it comes around to theatre and all its associated performing arts. So we've been going now for about 4 years with Celery Soup, and we went through a number of iterations. We went through Touch and Go, and we put it on for well, it was quite a time, actually. We put it on over a period of, I think it was 18 months to 2 years we put it on. and we just repeated it, basically. There were different directors, so it was a slightly different show, but mainly it was... and to be honest with you, you know, we got reasonable audiences. But I, you know, the time came when we had other stories to tell. And the first story that I wrote, to be honest with you, I got a little, and I think a lot of people did, we got a little fed up of doing the same thing. I performed a Touch and Go for 47 performances. I've never ever done that with any show throughout my entire life before that. So I then picked up on this story about the haunted fire station. And of course it was just round the corner from the theatre. And it was such a wonderful story and very easy to tell. It almost, you know, I sat in the middle of the theatre, I think it was one Saturday afternoon, and it just kind of wrote itself. You know, very easy to do. Barbara had given us her story. There were various other sources that I could use, like local books. And then when I wrote it, I actually sent it to Barbara and said, look, you know, are you all right with this? And she said, yeah. She said, the only thing I want to change in it is that the friend who comes to visit her from Coconut Grove, where Barbara first came from, she wanted her to be called Sue, because that was the name of her friend. So, you know, we try. It's interesting, you know, that you do these things, and when you first look at them, they're words on a piece of paper, and you don't really necessarily fully appreciate what there is behind that. But when the word is there, Barbara Farrell, you know, Barbara's alive. She, you know, I went and met the lady, very, very nice lady, very charming lady. And these people are sitting in the audience. So, you know, you're actually...
Okay, we're back after the vacuum break.
Okay, so as I say, you know, Barbara was an excellent source, very nice person. The story was easy to tell, and it didn't take much research, because it was just really all there. The only thing that we had to do was really knit together the story of the fireman and the story of Barbara, and then just push them together. And really, you know, I know you want me to talk about how I got involved in this, but this is it, you see. I kind of got fed up with doing Touch and Go. I said to myself, Peter, if you're going to do anything, you've got to write it yourself. So I sat down and wrote this story, and I passed it to the board of Creative Sanford. I said, look, I've written the story. We then had a meeting. I think I wrote this, I can't remember the exact dates, but I want to say I perhaps wrote the story in late November, and in December they had a meeting to discuss the next Touch and Go, called whatever it was going to be, by Celery Soup. And I was sat there in the audience, and they said, oh, the director's going to be X, and the choreographer's going to be Y, and this and that, and that we've got two playwrights. One is Laura Donaldson, the other's Peter Newman. And that is the first time I ever realised that I was a playwright for Creative Sanford. So it was, you know, they say, you know, some people seek greatness, others have it thrust upon them. Now, mine was well and truly thrust upon me. So, you know, I came away from that realizing that I really had to. But it's interesting, you know, because with that sort of thing, you know, you've got to start somewhere and get from A and get to B.
Well, this brings up, why do you do history? I mean, you know, part of this whole process, I guess, Swamp Gravy and all, how come you do history for this sort of thing?
Well, because that's what it's about. It's about bringing out the stories that local people have of what they've done, and turning that into some sort of play that you can perform in public. You know, we have, and I've sat through hours and hours and hours of these tapes and read, you know, people's reports on their lives, and a lot of them are the same. You know, I I was born here, I was raised here, my mom and dad were strict with me when I was young, I went to school, got a job, got married, had kids, had grandkids, and now here I am and I'm talking to you about it. And that might be over the course of 3 hours you get something like that. The secret with all of these things, Mark, is not merely to just put a recording device in front of somebody. What you have to do is actually drag out of them almost the interesting stories that they have. And there are very, very few people that come to us that really have interesting stories kind of laid out in front of you. We have two very notable exceptions there. And one is the family that tells us about Uncle Dieter. And the other is the family that tells us about Elmer Baggs. And the stories about those two individuals and individuals that were are absolute legion. And, you know, we have quite a few of them. But some of the rest of them, you really, really have to, you know, start digging and trying to get at it. And the history of it, of course, comes from the fact that, you know, history is really dependent upon how you define it. And for community theatre such as this, we're looking at contemporary history. So we're not going back 65 million years to dinosaurs. We're not going back 65,000 years. We're going back 65 years. We're looking at people's lifespans, at what they've actually done. People who can remember going back into the 1910s, the 1920s, and you know sometimes it's
collective memory.
It is very much a collective memory. The story that I wrote about the fire station starts with firemen coming back from a fire in 1923 of the Holy Cross Church, when it actually burned to the ground. Funnily enough, we actually also have a story, and I can't remember for the life of me who it is just off the top of my head, but it's obviously an older guy saying, you know, telling his story and whatever, and somebody says, oh yeah, tell him about how you burnt the Holy Cross Church down. And apparently this person was the night of the Holy Cross fire, he was baptized, and he always thought that it was a candle that they left after his baptism service that actually was responsible for burning the church down. But it just struck me as being, you know, very fascinating that here I've got the, you know, the Holy Cross Episcopal Church, and over here is the guy who's given his story that actually relates to that burning down. So, you know, some of the things that we could tell instead of being snippets could be much, much longer. But of course, you know, you have to bear in mind what it is and who you're dealing with, and you have to have an eye to the consumption of what you're actually producing, rather than just producing it for producing sake. It's not something that is it's not an academic exercise. You know, what you're dealing with living history, you're dealing with real people, you're dealing with their lives. It has to stand up to their own scrutiny. So if you tell me your tale and I turn that into a play, I could look you fairly and squarely in the eye and say, look, Mark, you know, here's your story that we're telling in front of all these people, and you'd be happy with that, as opposed to, you know, taking, kind of mangling it around and producing all sorts of other things there to make it a little more interesting. I'm sure you have lots of interesting stories, but, you know, that's nonetheless the way we have to have that at the back of our mind all the time.
So authenticity is something that's very important.
Authenticity is very important. I mean, you can take it to a degree. I mean, what you deal with, for example, you might, it's, I guess it's like a pudding, and in that pudding you've got raisins, and those raisins are the bits of authenticity, and then you sort of really pad other stuff in. You can't be authentic 100% of the time. The last story that I wrote for the Remade Not Bought was a story about a lady called Arthurine who worked in the tax office. And this was just a little story she had about being almost locked in there one night. and Arthur and actually came and sort of said, Arthur and Mona, that was a friend, that was absolutely authentic. But on to the end of that, I grafted this huge story about somebody writing a check on the side of a cow, which was not authentic at all. It was just, you know, a story, that's what it was. But it, you know, it made for good theatre. So what you always have to have an eye to, as I say, what the audience is. The audience will not sit there and listen to somebody going on about their childhood or anything like that, because it's not interesting. And you're asking these people to pay money to come and listen to what we are producing at Creative Sanford. And you've got to have something that they're interested in, because otherwise there's no point in doing it, because you're asking them to pay, and otherwise it's if they go along, they go away grumbling, saying, oh, it's not worth it, and all the rest of it. You might be all right for that show, but when it comes around to doing another show, then you find you've shot yourself in the foot and you've got a much bigger mountain to climb when it comes around to producing the audiences for a show like that.
Well, how do you pick your topics then? Apparently, from what we've heard, that there are a few key words or something that you might choose to sort of build stories around.
To a large extent, it depends on the sort of grist that you have for your mill. And it's not something that you have as a sort of list of topics that you may or may not choose. It's something that just stands up and hits you out of a story. Like, for example, when I wrote The Highwayman, that was something that Sanford Council, or was Seminole County lawyer, a guy called Doug Senstrom, he gave his story. And very long and actually very entertaining set of reminiscences. And out of this, there was a couple of lines about was it the paintings, or did he actually mention the highwayman, the Florida highwayman who painted these paintings in the 50s and the 60s and sold them. And one of the guys who was originally associated with Celery Soup, a guy called Perry Etchelberg, who actually lives over in Serenity Towers, Bram Towers as it was then. So I went and talked to Perry, and he said, yeah, we've got them here. And he showed me all the Harold Newton paintings that are there in the foyer. You still see the holes where they were screwed to the wall. And so I thought, well, this is such a... And funnily enough, at that time, there was something on the public radio that they were talking about that, doing something on the highwayman. And then I saw something else on the local TV. They were talking about doing the highwayman. So I thought, right, you know, and I'm going to get on and do my bit first. So I wrote this story, and the only really catch I could find in it, you know, something a little more interesting, was the fact they took all the highwaymen down when they renovated the building a number of years ago, and then they put them back up. So I originally entitled it The Mystery of the Missing Highwayman. It wasn't much of a mystery, but I mean, it was a nice story, I felt. You know, that kind of made it a little more interesting. But the actual history of the highwayman is fascinating, and I believe that over the next 3 or 4 years you'll perhaps see a lot more people coming out with a few more stories about the highwayman than what there's been to date. So, you know, how does anything stand up? It just does, you know. It just, I got a story about somebody who used to have the land lease for the Mayfair Golf Club. And I kind of researched it and then looked at it, and it took me a long time to actually find the angle that I wanted. But I wrote actually what I consider to be a funny piece, but it's we couldn't put it on because there was this court case going through between the people who had the lease of the golf course and Seminole County, who actually owned the land. And it was about who designed the golf course. So I wrote this story about who designed the Mayfair golf course. So if you come to see next time, hopefully that story might be in there. Yeah.
Well, we did see two that we're interested in, we've sort of focusing on. One of them is about the rolling pin, and the other story is about Dr. Stark. And we're interested in how you pick those and how you approach them.
Well, first stories. Of all, the rolling pin, now, when we did this iteration of Celery Soup, there were two, as I said before, there were two of us writing. One was Laura Donaldson and the other was me. Now, Laura actually found the story about the rolling pin. And again, she got it from somebody who came in, told the story about the cannon and its wheels and what have you. And she produced a really nice little story about, you know, the rolling pin and the kids and the mother and how they used to roll it out. And, you know, they were using a bit of history with that. Dr. Stark, that we used to have a lady who was, she was in the original Touch and Goes, and then actually she moved on to the board of Creatives of Samford. She's a, she used to be a professor at Seminole Community College, and she said, talk to me about this Dr. Stark. And she had a lot of information on it, which she gave to me. And, you know, you read all this stuff. And, I mean, Stark's interesting because he was there. If you go down to the Orlando Museum in downtown, you'll see they've got a big display about Henry Stark and the bombing in Mims in 1951. You know, when they kill the NAACP local secretary. So that's all pretty graphically laid out. I went down and had a look at that. And then Henry Stark's son, I think his name's George, he was he became a lawyer, and he's a very well known financier, and he lives up in New York somewhere. I've never gotten a hold of him, but he's still around. But the story about Stark, I mean, it's a really good story, and there's a lot of detail there, and it affects a lot of people. It was really, how do you, you know, tell it, a story like that? And I noticed when I was going through, there's a little tiny little footnote that said that when the original researchers were producing all this information, it said, as told to us by his daughter in a restaurant in 1964 or whenever it was. So that I kind of took that, and that's how I got the idea of the restaurant and kind of bringing it in like that, which I felt was a good way of telling and putting it in some sort of context. But it was interesting that I'm not, as you probably gathered, a native of Samford, but
live here, work here, play here.
But when we did the original Touch and Go, there was a guy called Will Saunders and his brother Tommy. They're both black guys. And Will is, you know, they're really, really nice guys that they were. And Will was, he used to be on the board of Creative Samford as well, but he said he preferred to, it was a toss-up between Creative Samford and watching his football. He preferred to watch his football, so, you know, that's fine. But Will's a great one for photography. And, you know, he's taken thousands and thousands of photos of the Touch and Go shows over the years. In fact, I believe they're his photos that there are there at the down there at the theatre. But he came to the Stark when we first did the Stark play, and he came down and said to me afterwards, he said, you know, he said, Peter, he said, Dr. Stark, he said, he actually delivered me and Tommy. So, you know, it's little things like that, you know, just make you realise that you're not dealing with just words on a piece of paper. No, this is actually community history, and there are people there. Even the lady, Nancy Ford, who's in the show, I think she was delivered by Dr. Stark as well. So, you know, obviously a very, very well-known guy. And you know, such a you know, his attitude towards people was unbelievable. It really was. You know, this string of humanity kind of pours out of the fellow. You know, and to appear twice in Time magazine is shows us no slouch either. So,
well, how do you deal with counter narrative or say gaps in your story or maybe sensitive areas?
Sensitive areas, of course, you know, at Sanford, there was segregation here, obviously, until the mid-70s. And I was actually going to write a story about the segregation of the schools, which occurred between Coombs and Sanford and the high school, which was in 1972-73. There's a friend of mine was there, Nancy Ford was there at that time as well, and they both had their particular stories to tell. But then, of course, we had the whole Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman thing, and the board really felt that, you know, you could wade around in this till the cows come home, but they didn't really feel that it was something that we necessarily wanted to overplay. And in fact, you know, there is obviously there's a black element to this, and there's a white element to this, and really, I mean. Personally, I'd like to see the things be a little closer together. You know, it's very difficult to write the stories that we've got if you've not confident that you've got the people, you know, the black people to come and play the parts. I mean, look, you know, luckily we had some really good people, but it's, you know, it's particularly men. In the sort of 30 to 50 age range, whether they're black, white, or whatever colour, you know, you just can't get hold of them. It's not the sort of thing that really, you know, does very much for them. So you've got to always bear that in the back of your mind. But certainly, you know, we are conscious of the fact that, you know, Sanford has perhaps, I don't know, whether it's an unenviable reputation because of what's happened in the past. And you don't have to look very far to find it either. In terms of other things, if you look at something like Uncle Dieter, I mean, when I first saw that, they actually asked me to play Uncle Dieter in Touch and Go, which I did. I was a little chary about it because, of course, you know, he was wasn't quite an idiot savant, but very much the sort of in the play Rain Man, you know, it's true, you know, that you could give him your birth date and he would tell you just like that what day of the week it was. You know, he lived life to his own beat of the drum. You know, he would do things in his own particular way that nobody else would think of doing. He had this, perhaps you didn't see Touch and Go, but he had this rooster that he used to carry around with him that had no legs, and the joke was, of course, where do you find a roost with no legs? Where do you find a roost with no legs? Exactly where you left it. But apparently, what we found out, the reason why this rooster had no legs is because the rooster caught, I think it was some sort of parasite or something like that. And they advised Dieter to bathe the rooster's legs in gasoline. I mean, and this would be sort of, you know, like putting on a bit of gasoline on a cloth and then just rubbing it down or something like that. But he stuck this bird in the gasoline for hours. Of course, eventually, it lost its legs because of the effect of the gasoline, so he used to carry the rooster around, you know. Just a man very much, you know, following his own light. And, you know, with people like that, as I say, it's, you know, it's very easy to write stories about them. And with people like that, you know, you're not demeaning them or doing anything like that. And I think really that when it comes round to looking at, I mean, it's not just here, it's anywhere, you know. We've got a mix of cultures, you've got a mix of people, you know, some are old and some are young. So long as you don't demean them or run them down, which is totally unnecessary, not what we're about at all, then I think you can legitimately tell their story to any audience that you would care to invite through the door.
Very good. All right. So you're telling stories about ourselves to ourselves.
Exactly. I mean, let's be honest, I mean, you know, you have a story. You might think, well, you know, okay, fine, but I mean, you have a story. You've got more than one. You've got a lot of stories. And it's really up to the person who's doing the interviewing just to kind of drag that story out of the person who is the interviewee. I mean, you know, not everybody sits down and goes on and on and on and on like I do. You know, sometimes it's, you know, it's very, very difficult to just bring the person back saying, well, you know, you said about this and then what about that? But that is the only way that you can do it, to get hold of information from them that you can't get from 1,000 other people, because you're not talking about their lives per se. You're talking about their lives in Sanford and how they interacted within the environment and the community. And of course, that's not what everybody does around here, because some people live in Longwood, some people live in Tallahassee, some people live in Nigeria. You know, they're all born and raised in a family and perhaps go to school and have kids and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But it's the environment that really makes the person, and the way that they interact with the environment and other people. That's what makes an interesting story.
How does the community react to your plays and
Well, generally speaking, we've had. It's true to say that as soon as you put anything on and hold it up as being, here is a spectacle for somebody to look at, and you're asking them to pay money to come and see it, it holds itself up to ridicule, criticism, call it whatever you will, and we've had a fair share of criticism. You know, people criticise that it's there's too many stories about black people. There's not enough stories about white people, or, you know, this or that, or whatever. But to me, that is just healthy criticism. If somebody came along and said, you know, my name is Mrs. X, and my mother gave you this story, and what you've just done with my mother's story I think is awful, I would be very, very upset about that, and I'd want to know why this had happened. But, you know, touch wood, we've never had anything like that. Nobody's ever said, you know, that what you've done is terrible to the story that I did. In fact, when I played Elmer Baggs in the first show, Marlene Baggs came up and said, you know, that I really enjoyed it. I got the same thing from Uncle Dieter and one of his nieces. She said that she enjoyed it as well, because, you know, we didn't demean the person. You know, we told the story. And if you add a bit of a twist of humour to it as well, or a twist of mystery, you know, that doesn't take the thing beyond the realms of probability, then that's really what you have to do, you know, when you're telling all of these things. You know, if the people had died and you tell the story about the founding of Sanford or something like that, and you go back to Colonel Sanford, and there were two of them, him and a general, and they kind of tossed up to see, you know, what it was going to be called and all the rest of it. They weren't really proper army generals, and you can do that, but and it is history. But if you're trying to be sort of faithful to the idea of a community historical performance, then it's as much as you possibly can, if you can use live testimony as to something that you get out of a history book, then I believe that's really what you should be aiming to do.
Well, how do you go about collecting these histories?
Same way as you do it with... We've done Tea and Tells, and these little recorders here are a godsend, because you just put them on the table and people talking to them. And, you know, sometimes you've got to sit and listen to them. Sometimes they transpose onto a paper or something like that so you can sit and read them. But, you know, it's an art, I think. Interviewing people and getting what you need to get out of them is an art. But generally speaking, there are very, very few people who don't want to come in and talk about themselves. You know, not everybody, but, you know, generally speaking, people aren't reticent to talk about their lives once you kind of start the ball rolling with them. It's, you know, it's a fascinating subject. You know, you can sit and talk about yourself all night long if you really think about it.
Do you have writing background?
Personally, no. The only writing that I mean, I was associated with a theatrical group in the UK for a long, long time, and I did all sorts of stuff there, including writing. But I've never actually sat down and written a book or written a play or done anything like that. It's just kind of dabbling here and there. And this one is as good a place to dabble as any other, because you're just looking at little bites that you're performing. You know, nothing is more than 5 or 6 minutes long, and you know, you try to build the characters to make them interesting. And you know, I know, you know, how these things should work because I've had so much experience of doing it in the past. But you can't afford, I mean, you can't afford a lot of subtle nuances. You know, we're not talking about Broadway theatre and people who are going to the theatre every week or something like that. What you're doing is you are producing mass entertainment, and as such, it has to be pitched at a certain level. So, you know, it's not a question of using complicated plot lines that go on for half an hour, or spending 20 minutes trying to work out how a person's psyche is actually affecting everybody within the play. No, you've got to have something that's quick, that's lively, that keeps people's attention. And people have a very short attention span for things like this, generally speaking. So it's got to be that. It's got to be, there's a certain amount of razzmatazz that has to go with it. At the end of the day, you've got to produce a commercial article, because that's what you're going to go out and sell. So, yeah, you know, I mean, when I first wrote the Fireman, you know, I had all sorts of stuff in it. But it was severely cut down because, of course, it was just not required. So, yeah, you've got to be careful with these sorts of things.
Well, what do we have to look forward to in the future?
Well, it's more of the same. You know, we have got some more stories here. I've got three that I've written. So there's the one about the golf course. There's one that I wrote about a policeman's dog that used to go and test door handles by itself. And then I also wrote one about a fight. It was when, again, this was going back to the school's integration. And it was a story that a lady gave us, and I wrote about that. So, you know, that's a bit of a kernel there. And then we've got other things. And I believe that UCF also has a library of things, because it might well be that, you know, we've tried to kind of keep it to Sanford. But, you know, perhaps we extend it to Seminole County, something like that. But there are still a lot of people here. I mean, even during the last show, one of the guys who plays, he played one of the firemen, and he was also the president of the Sanford Local Business Society right at the end there. His name's Mike. He said that he knew a guy. I think actually this guy had rented him a house or sold him a house. He said that this guy's father used to brew moonshine over the other side of Lake Monroe there, and you know, the stories that he could tell. So, you know, you've got to kind of keep your ears open for something like this, and you know, just follow up on them. If it's something, particularly if it's something interesting like that. So, you know, we'll look and see if we can't get something that's light and entertaining next time. That's what we need, light and entertaining.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
I hope I've been light and entertaining.
Yes, you have. Dramatically so.
Thank you.
Good, thank you.
All right.
I do appreciate it.